From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, a walk on the paranormal side. Back in St. Louis for about a month, here's what's happening. Well, the number of confirmed cases of measles in the United States this year has now jumped by nearly 20% in the week just ending April 11th, and the country's second worst outbreak in nearly two decades, according to federal health officials. They don't know what the surge is and why it's happening. Attorney General William Barr plans on Thursday morning to release the redacted version of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election and contacts between Moscow and President Donald Trump's campaign, if there were any. We'll find out when the report is issued. It's redacted, though, so we're not going to get everything. After a long night of work by more than 400 Paris firefighters, the fire at the Notre Dame Cathedral is beginning to cool, but what a disaster. We're still not sure about the extent of the damage, but as Paris and the rest of the world watch the fire slowly dying, attention starts to shift to what can be salvaged and rebuilt. Art historians and architects have incredible records of the cathedral, which has been damaged, rebuilt, nearly abandoned, and renovated many times throughout its long history. Notre Dame's roof and its support structure of 800-year-old oak timbers had almost completely succumbed to the flames, the cause of the fire really not yet known. If you haven't pulled your tax return together yet and sent it to the IRS by now, well, you're just about out of time, unless, of course, you're on an extension. But when are we going to get something like the fair tax? Let's check in with Bill Spillane. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, George, and thank you for bringing attention to the fair tax.
When are we going to get some change?
Well, I don't know. Donald Trump, when he was campaigning, he said we should have a simple tax code, either the fair tax or the flat tax. He was misinformed about the flat tax. But in any case, he mentioned specifically the fair tax. And we just have to get our troops organized and go get it.
You know, you and I have been talking about it almost every year for the last several years. Do you think we're getting any closer to some kind of fair tax?
I think so. As soon as people can see, and the president sees, and his advisors see, that he's fighting a great fight in terms of our trading partners and so forth. But his tariffs are nothing compared to embedded taxes in our goods and services. We are fighting an uphill battle for our trading partners. And if we just set fair tax and eliminate all those embedded taxes, we'd be home free in trade. We'd have so many more jobs. We'd have capital investment. The fair tax is a winner, winner. Fairtax.org on the internet.
You got it. Thank you, Bill. We'll talk to you soon. Keep in touch with us. Let us know if there are any further developments. Spring arrived weeks ago in the Windy City, but then on Sunday, winter made an abrupt return, bringing significant snowfall to Chicago, as well as places in Missouri, Indiana, and Michigan. Chicago's O'Hare Airport was whitened by more than 5 inches of snow. Planes were canceled and delayed. As a matter of fact, I was in Denver taping our Beyond Belief television programs this weekend. One of our guests was John St. Augustine, who was from Chicago. He couldn't get back. They had to make provisions for him. Well, Queen, the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, already has the highest grossing film ever for a musical, surpassing $900 million in worldwide ticket sales on Sunday. That's a remarkable feat. Bohemian Rhapsody, it's the biopic of the Queen group, $900 million at the box office already. What else is going on in the skies these days? Let's check in with Stephen Cates. Stephen, what do you have for us this month?
And hi there, George. We continue with space. It's on everybody's mind, and hopefully people got to see the second successful launch of SpaceX's Falcon Heavy, a great launch, and we'll be excited for more to come. But they just, George, that is SpaceX, won a new contract. They will be launching a NASA spacecraft known as DART, which will head toward an asteroid called Didymos. And this particular spacecraft, once it heads there, will actually image and impact the tiny little moon around this particular asteroid called Didymos B with an impactor to see just how these asteroids were created. But, George, I think the most amazing picture, and we probably have so many people interested in, is the amazing image from the Event Horizon Telescope. Did you actually get to see that? Isn't that incredible?
Oh, it's dramatic.
It's just totally incredible. And I want to make people aware that the first time we heard about this, people were thinking that we were going to be imaging what we think is a black hole at the center of the Milky Way. But no, this is a galaxy, a giant elliptical galaxy known as M87. I watch it, and many people regularly see it in a telescope. It's 55 million light years distant. And we obviously see, and this is so incredible, because it's not an optical telescope. This is all through radio waves. We're getting to see the event horizon. And, George, this is really amazing. If the sun and the Earth were ever to shrink down
yes.
to become a black hole, you'd have to shrink the sun down to a little less than 3 miles in diameter. And in order for the Earth to actually become a black hole with great gravity pressure far beyond this discussion, the Earth would have to be the size of 9 millimeters in diameter.
Amazing.
So can you imagine the size and pressures inside the black hole? But the live sky, we wrap it up, George, as always. Meteor shower fever, folks. If you look into the northeastern sky just after midnight, before this beautiful full pink moon starts to take place and fully in effect by the 19th, maybe upwards of 5 to 10 Lyrid meteors will be seen. But George, something really cool. If sky watchers look into the morning sky with clear skies, a rare treat to see both the innermost planet Mercury and brilliant Venus, the goddess of love and beauty, they'll only be about 4 degrees apart. A rare opportunity for sky watchers and photographers. And as always, Dr. Sky reminds everyone, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. Email me at drsky@cox.net.
Super. Thank you, Dr. Sky. As we reported last week, researchers say they have found fossil bones and teeth of a previously unknown human species in the northern Philippines. Scientists named the species Homo luzonensis after the island of Luzon, where the discovery was made. Researchers recently reported the finding in a study published in Nature. It's an amazing story. Up next, the forbidden archaeologist joins us, Michael Cremo, to talk about this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Michael Cremo, our special guest for the next couple hours, also known as the forbidden archaeologist, hailed as a groundbreaking research pioneer and international authority in archaeological anomalies as well. Several of his books include Forbidden Archaeology, The Forbidden Archaeologist, Divine Nature, Human Devolution as well. Michael, welcome back to the program. We've missed you.
Good to be with you, George, and all your listeners.
So what do you think of this discovery of this fossil of bones and teeth found in northern Philippines?
Well, it's a very interesting discovery. It illustrates a lot of points about how archaeology really works. I think one of the really significant things is it complexifies our picture of human origins. Yeah, these discoveries aren't particularly old. They're about 50,000 years old, and there are really not many items involved in the discoveries. You've really got 7 teeth and a couple of finger bones and a couple of toe bones, and that's about it. But they have human-like features, but not exactly like modern Homo sapiens. So the researchers think that about 50,000 years ago, there were human beings like us existing, and there were other species, also very human-like, existing at the same time. And this calls to mind one of the statements from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which tell us there are 400,000 human-like species existing in this universe that we inhabit. So it could be that this discovery represents the finding of the remains of one of those 400,000 human-like species that the ancient Sanskrit writings of India speak about.
Michael, tell us what you think this creature would have looked like many years ago.
Well, you've only got a few bones to go on. As I said, they've got a few teeth, a few small finger bones, a few small toe bones, and part of a femur, I believe. So it could have been. Now, one of the foot bones that they have is a metatarsal. That's the bone that is in the center of the foot. You know, you have your toe bones, and the toe bones connect to long bones in the foot, in the main body of the foot. And this metatarsal is heavily curved, which means that the foot was probably adapted for life in the trees. So this creature, based on the evidence from this very curved metatarsal foot bone, sort of indicates it would probably have been human-like, but adapted to life in the forest or the trees.
Michael, why does it take so long to discover these different kinds of creatures?
Well, one thing is that scientists originally had the idea that human evolution proceeded in a linear fashion. First, they thought there was Australopithecus, and they believed Australopithecus turned into Homo habilis, who turned into Homo erectus, who turned into Neanderthal man, who turned into anatomically modern humans. But as they've gone on, as they've conducted research over the years, they've discovered that the pattern seems to be one of coexistence rather than linear evolution, so that you have many human-like species coexisting at the same time. It's kind of been a gradual process. You know, they came up a few years ago with the Denisovans, which were a primitive human-like species related to the Neanderthals and early Homo sapiens. And then they came up with the discovery of Homo floresiensis in Indonesia, which they've nicknamed the Hobbit. And now they've got this other human-like species from Luzon in the Philippines that they're calling Homo luzonensis. It's a gradual process, but I think they're coming to the point of understanding that humans like us have coexisted with more ape-like human species for, I would say, the coexistence goes back many millions of years. And gradually, they're pushing things further and further back. They haven't gotten back as far as I believe the evidence really shows. So I think they're making baby steps in the right direction.
Do you think this discovery, Michael, kind of vindicates you and others who believe that mankind might be much older than most scientists and archaeologists tell us?
Well, not this particular discovery, because this is about 50,000 years old, and that sort of fits in with what mainstream science thinks about the age of our Homo sapiens species, anatomically modern humans. Most scientists today would say that humans like us first came into existence about 200,000 years ago. So this new discovery at 50,000 years is within the acceptable range. But, you know, I was looking at the report on the National Geographic website, and there's something very interesting that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. It's just barely mentioned in a sentence in the National Geographic website report about these Philippine discoveries. It seems that the Philippine archaeologist Armand Mijares, who made these discoveries at the Calo Cave and on the island of Luzon in the Philippines, made another discovery nearby where he found stone tools and a butchered rhinoceros skeleton in layers of rock about 700,000 years old. So that's not mentioned in most of the reports, but I think it's very, very interesting, you know, that he's actually got evidence for a human presence going back over 700,000 years. And that starts getting into the range of what I call forbidden archaeology, where you start really getting into deep time.
Gosh, would you like to have been around during this time period, Michael, and just witnessed some of these things?
Well, in a sense, we are witnessing these things. We're witnessing these discoveries. But, yeah, it's interesting that you're talking about that because, you know, there was a South African scientist who worked in the Sterkfontein Caves in South Africa. His name was J.T. Robinson, and he made many important discoveries of Australopithecus. But, you know, you read about that in the textbooks. What you don't read about in the textbooks is that he had a psychic who was working with him. And, you know, he took this psychic down into the Sterkfontein Caves, and he had the man, the psychic, lie down, and then he would put fossils of Australopithecus on his forehead. And in his trance, this psychic was able to envision what was actually happening with these creatures millions of years ago. So I think through different paranormal methods, it may be possible to get a direct vision of the past, what was actually going on. I remember once, I was speaking about this at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that was held in the country of Jordan a few years ago. I was speaking about how this very famous archaeologist, J.T. Robinson, had used the psychic to help him in his research. And one of the archaeologists told me, well, I never heard of that before. And I said, well, that's what I'm here for, to tell you something you don't already know. Because in one sense, many times the archaeologist and the scientist are just repeating things that they already know. They're not really breaking any new ground.
It's amazing, though, Michael, what's been happening. Since you came out with Forbidden Archaeology, you were one of the few standing out there all by yourself. Have other scientists and archaeologists finally joined you?
Well, I think they're gradually making progress in the right direction. You know, when I was writing Forbidden Archaeology, most scientists believe the human species was only about 100,000 years old. Now they've gone back to 200,000 or 300,000 years. So that's a step in the right direction. Also, as I said, they didn't. One thing that we were talking about in Forbidden Archaeology was the idea that humans like us were coexisting with other human-like creatures, and now that's become the mainstream idea. Although they didn't really have that idea at the time that Forbidden Archaeology was first published in 1993. So I've seen them take steps in the right direction, but I think they've got a long way to go before they arrive at the real truth of the antiquity of our species.
All right, Michael, stay with us. We'll come back and talk more about some of your incredible discoveries. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with the forbidden archaeologist, Michael Cremo, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with the hidden archaeologist, Michael Cremo. We'll take calls with Michael next hour. Michael, years ago on the program, you told us a story that is absolutely riveting about some metal spheres, little spheres that were found deep down in the planet when they were doing some digging. Tell us that story again. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's one of the more extreme anomalies, George. Those are the round metallic spheres from South Africa. They come from a mine in the western Transvaal region near the town of Ottosdal. And yeah, they're interesting objects. They're 1 or 2 inches in diameter. Some of them are perfectly spherical. I gave one once to a MUFON researcher who used a jewelry saw to saw it in half, and then he measured the radius of it, and he said the radius deviated only by less than a thousandth of an inch all the way around, which means it was perfectly round. And they were analyzed, and they're made of hematite, which is a semi-precious stone. It's actually a kind of an iron ore. So they're really interesting objects. The most interesting feature is the parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. You know, they look like they were made by someone with human-like intelligence, but they're found in mineral deposits in the mines over 2 billion, not million, but 2 billion years old. So they're really interesting objects. I went to South Africa, and I met the chief mining engineer from the mine where these things come from, and he showed me a block of mineral from the mine with these objects, these spherical objects solidly embedded in this chunk of rock. And, you know, some of them were partially protruding from the surface of the rock, and I could see the grooves. They went right around the exposed surface of the objects back into the solid rock, which sort of shows that they're a genuinely old feature of the spheres, these grooves that are engraved on them. So they're really interesting objects. Nobody's really giving me a very satisfactory explanation of how they could have formed naturally in the layers of the earth. So they're one of the most interesting and challenging of the anomalies that we can find if we look at all of the evidence that's really available to us.
Michael, I got to ask you, you went to India just recently. Tell me what you were looking for, what you may have discovered out there, and then let's talk about some of the old Indian scripts and some of the things they've been talking about,
yeah,
the Vimanas and things like that.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the topic of Vimanas or spacecraft, because the main reason I went to India is because I'm involved as a consultant for a project there that's called the Temple of the Vedic Planetarium. It's going to be a combination of a huge domed temple combined with a planetarium that's dedicated to the ancient Vedic cosmology, which involves the idea that we exist in a multiverse, you know, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, there are millions of universes, not just one universe. So, and in these different universes, there's intelligent life in all of them. There's intelligent life from the beginning of the universe to the end of it. And these intelligent life forms have technologies such as vimanas or spacecraft of different kinds. And as I was mentioning a little bit earlier before, another feature of this Vedic cosmology is that there are 400,000 human-like species scattered throughout the entire universe. So I'm part of a group that's going to be planning the exhibits and planetarium shows for this project, which is scheduled to open in 2022. It's located in West Bengal in India. So that's a project that I've been involved in, and it involves depicting for the general public various aspects of the ancient Vedic cosmology, which modern science is kind of supporting, in the sense that modern scientists, modern astrophysicists, are now beginning to speak of the idea of many universes or a multiverse. They're beginning to consider the presence of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. So a lot of interesting developments going on that front.
Exciting projects, aren't they?
Absolutely. I'm really pleased to be involved.
I mean, if you can only imagine, Michael, and I'm sure you have, what things might have looked like hundreds of thousands of years ago. I mean, with these possible Vimanas flying around and the technology that they had, just truly remarkable, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, there's different sources of information about the ancient past. One source of such information is what we can find in the record of the rocks. Another source of information is that we can find in the writings left by these ancient civilizations. Am I coming through? I was hearing a little bit of...
Yeah, no, you're coming through loud and clear.
Okay. All right, yeah, I just heard a little bit of static there. So, all around India, I find it very fascinating. There are sacred places that commemorate events that took place millions of years ago. There are temples that commemorate events that took place in human society millions of years ago. And these places all have extraterrestrial connections. You know, for example, there's a temple in South India at a place called Sri Rangam. And the main deity that's worshipped at that temple is said to have an extraterrestrial origin. It came to Earth millions of years ago and has been worshipped for millions of years by human civilizations on this planet. So it's, you know, very interesting to see things like that. Or go to the Ellora cave temples near the town of Aurangabad in northwestern India, and you can see these huge temples carved into the solid rock, kind of like, you know, they have in Jordan in the Middle East, that I'm trying to recall the name of that place.
Well, and I got to tell you too. Didn't Robert Oppenheimer, one of our fathers of our nuclear age, once say that in reading some writings from India, that he came across information hundreds of thousands of years ago, which made him believe that they may have had a nuclear war or some kind of explosion?
Yeah, well, such descriptions are there in the ancient Sanskrit writings. They speak of a weapon called the Brahmastra. And Robert Oppenheimer, he was a physicist. He was in charge of the American program to develop the atomic bomb during World War II. And when the first atomic bomb was tested at Alamogordo in New Mexico in 1945, he was there in the bunker, and he watched it go off, and it made this tremendous light. And there was a lot of energy released. So he began reciting verses from the ancient Sanskrit writings, from the Bhagavad Gita, one of the ancient Indian texts that describe how the forces of the universe are like 1,000 suns all together in one place. And it's a very destructive force generating a lot of heat and light. So he was aware of these descriptions, and he referred to them later when he was asked about what he was thinking about when he saw the first atomic bomb go off at Alamogordo in New Mexico. And he actually said to a reporter, "This is just the first one in modern times," kind of indicating that he thought that previously in ancient India they had a similar kind of weapon.
You know, Michael, since you and I have been talking about these incredible discoveries, so many other things continue to happen. I know this is speculation, but what do you expect next to occur?
In terms of future discoveries?
Yeah. I mean, I know it's all speculative because how would you know, but What do you expect based on all the research you've been doing? What do you think they'll stumble across?
Well, I think gradually they're going to keep pushing the origin of the human species further and further back in time. And that's going to start changing the way they think about their theories of human origins. Because ultimately, I think they're going to understand that you can't explain our origin simply in material terms, simply in terms of atoms and molecules and DNA and things like that. We're going to have to consider mind and consciousness as independently existing realities. Yeah, that we exist in a consciousness-based universe. And I think they're going to have to deal with that.
I think so. That's going to be dramatic all by itself. And once again, Michael, it backs up the things you've been saying for years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, gradually, you know, things are moving in the right direction in some ways, but they've got a lot further to go before they start getting an idea that's close to what really exists.
How did you get involved in this in the first place many years ago, Michael?
Well, yeah, that I think it's something I started in a previous lifetime. And then, you know, when I encountered these kinds of ideas in this lifetime, I was naturally attracted to them. I think it's something that really can't be explained in terms of one lifetime. But, you know, just in terms of this lifetime, you know, I can see that the way that I was raised had some influence on me. You know, my father was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force. So that meant a couple things for me as I was growing up. First of all, it meant that our family was traveling around, so I was getting exposed to a lot of different ideas, a lot of different cultures, a lot of different kinds of people, so I could see there was more than one way to look at things. And also because I grew up among people who were involved in the intelligence services and the diplomatic service, I could understand there is such a thing as hidden knowledge. There are things going on in the world that most people simply don't know about. You know, they don't have access to this information. So that prepared me to understand that even in the world of science, there is such a thing as hidden knowledge, forbidden knowledge, things that are kept out of view that really, if we did know them, would really influence our thinking, and not just our thinking, but our way of organizing our lives. So I think those who want to keep the status quo, they have to keep the knowledge filtered so that, you know, there's an appropriate set of ideas that encourages people to stick with the status quo. So as I said, the way that I was raised prepared me to understand that the status quo, in terms of its intellectual aspect and its social aspect, its political aspect, its economic aspect, may not be the ultimate truth.
Well, you're probably right about that, Michael. We're going to take phone calls next hour with you. And if we were to slap up this entity that was discovered in Luzon against a chimpanzee and a human, which would it look more like?
It appears it would be more human-like as far as I can see. As I say, a lot of times scientists are dealing with very fragmentary information. As I said, what they've really got is not a complete skeleton of the creature, so you could really give an answer to the question.
Good point. Michael, stay with us. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. The phone lines are now open. You get a chance to talk to the forbidden archaeologist, Michael Cremo.